You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
In this motion picture, you are the central character.
And welcome to episode 194 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Lisa Leahy from Rabbit Hole Podcasts to discuss a 1990 film that has a cop against a satanic serial killer with superpowers. Starring Lou Diamond Phillips, Tracy Griffith, and Jeff Kober, directed by Robert Reznikoff, it's The First Power. But first...
Miss Adams, why should we study...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
Yum, yum. It's time for a tasty and refreshing snack. Promise to satisfy your hunger, your thirst, your sweet tooth. So visit our refreshment center now. Let's go!
There are words men live by, words of strength, of wisdom, and of peace. We urge you to find the spiritual comfort and guidance we all so greatly need by attending your place of worship regularly. Names of merchants who give dividend tickets are listed in the lobby of the theater and on circulars at the concession stand. Dividend tickets will be accepted on all standard box office priced films. So take a circular with you today and start saving dividend tickets tomorrow when you shop. See your next movie completely free.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
Life was good to the Perrys of Pequot Landing. For 300 years, they lived in this place. the generations were rich with love. And the most beloved of all were the twins, Niles and Holland.
Please.
That summer they shared a secret life. In the apple cellar. In the nursery. In the night.
Holland, where is the baby? Don't get scared, Holland. Something awful could happen. We can still play the game. She doesn't have to know. We could play it in secret. Ada knows everything.
Look there, child. Think as I have taught you.
Now.
Imagine, Tushka, all your being.
Niles, what is it?
For the Perrys of New England, terrible things began to happen that summer.
Tell me, what is it like?
It was a summer of secrets. Secret treasures. Secret places.
Come on, little brother.
But the most frightening secret of all is yet to come.
I think I saw him down by the park.
Thomas Tryon, author of the best-selling novel, and Robert Mulligan, director of The Summer of 42, present a chilling new concept of terror and madness.
Oh, my God, my
George,
God.
What is it? George, what is it? What happened? George, what is it? What happened? Oh, my God.
There have been all the others. Now there is the other.
Holland, where is the baby?
And now, on with the show.
Good-looking bride, nice threads. Doesn't look like a nut. Says she knows who did it, and she'll only talk to you, man. Let's give the lady what she wants.
Detective Logan, Miss.
Seton, Tess Seton. I didn't want to come here, but I didn't know what else to do.
Well, you did the right thing. Sit down, please. Why don't you tell me what you know about the officer's death? You seem frightened, Miss Seton.
You really don't know, do you? You really don't know who killed her.
Why don't you tell me?
The Pentagram Killer. Patrick Channing, the Pentagram Killer.
I don't have time to play games.
Games? You talk about games? I saw you on TV celebrating a man's execution like it was a party. Bye-bye, Patrick. Adios. Good riddance. Except he's back. You might have executed his body. But his spirit has been released.
Oh, I see.
His spirit.
Yes, his spirit. And I am frightened. I am very frightened.
Thank you for coming in, Miss Seton.
Don't patronize me. I am not some crackpot. I am a professional psychic. I helped the St. Louis Police Department find a missing child.
Well, this isn't about a missing child, is it, Miss Seton?
No. It's murder. And it's not going to stop. You are not dealing with a man anymore. He's become a force.
I promise you I'll do the best I can.
You've already broken one promise to me. You promised no death penalty. You lied.
That was you? Who Well, it's certainly a pleasure to meet you, Miss Seaton. I've been looking forward to this. Actually, I wanted to thank you. How well did you know Channing?
I didn't.
Then how did you know where he was going next?
Look, I try to stay away from police work, but when I saw the picture of the little girl he killed, I opened myself up to him. And I've never felt such blackness and rage.
So you used your psychic powers to figure out where he was going next. I suppose that's also how you got my home phone number.
Now, I have a friend who works at the phone company. Look, I helped you, and you broke your promise to me, and now he's not just after you. He's after me, too.
How do I reach you?
You call me, Logan. Soon.
Okay, our movie this time is The First Power from 1990. And joining me to discuss this film is Lisa Leahy from Rabbit Hole Podcasts. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Todd. I'm excited to be here. I really kind of was interested in this particular title, so I've got a lot to talk about.
Excellent. Well, yeah, this is a wild one. We will get into that here in a moment. But before we do, please remind everybody about who you are and what you do.
Sure. So I am an English teacher by day and a podcaster by night. I am a horror movie fan, bit of a nerd on that end, and a big old book reader. So the Rabbit Hole podcasts you can hear me on are Between the Scares, which Jason Soto and I are working our way through every film that Jason Blum or Blumhouse Productions have put out into the world. A lot of horror fans, thank goodness for that. Horror movies all over the place. Super exciting. And a relatively new podcast that we started earlier this year called Pictures and Conversations. And it's a book club. So we pick a book and we talk about it on the 20th of every month. So August's book is American Gods, and September's book is The Book Eaters. So if you're interested in books and hearing what a bunch of nerdy podcasters have to say about those books, check us out.
Neither one of those is familiar to me, but I admit to not being very much of a reader. I enjoy reading, but I'm slow at it. Takes me a long time to read a book, and I'm much more visually oriented, so I focus on movies. But there are a few, and like, I'm always interested to see, especially when it's a book that is, it has been turned into a movie, I'm always interested to see, you know, how they do things and what they keep, what they throw out, and, you know, try hard to separate the two in my mind and not get too hung up on, you know, did they change this part of the book that I like and things like that. You know, I know that can be a stumbling block for folks.
They did make a TV show for American Gods, and it was pretty good. Stars did that one. And I'm pretty sure it's been canceled at this point. It was like 3 seasons. And the first season is really the only one I watched because they started changing the casting and then things get drawn out and I get grumpy about that. But the first season was excellent. And, you know, if you think that it takes you a while to read books, you know, an audiobook might be an option too, because I always have audiobooks going.
Yeah.
And there are some really great narrators out there. So who knows? Maybe you're driving around, you're listening to a book.
I used to do that quite a bit. That's when I had a longer commute than I have now. My commute is not very big at all, like 15 minutes, and 2 days of the week I get to work at home. So, you know, that throws
enough
that up. But back in the day, there were several, you know, that were like books that I knew for years and years that I wanted to read, but I knew I'd never be able to tackle them by actually reading them. And so I did do the books on tape, and they were tapes back then. I had a car with a tape deck, you know, and I didn't have a CD player yet. So I remember I did a lot of sci-fi back then. I did several of the Dune books, I know were, you know, would have been way too challenging for me to read. The guy that did it was not the best narrator, but he certainly did a bunch of funny voices for some of the characters. So I got into that. And I remember doing Starship Troopers too, you know, which I know the movie is quite a bit different just stylistically than the book is, but
it's
it was interesting.
It's what I've heard. I've only seen it and I love it as is, so I don't need to read the book.
Yeah. Now, you talked about Between the Scares,
yes.
And you're doing all the Blumhouse movies and that. And one of the things I was going to ask you about was, I know you're a horror fan, and
yes,
we're coming up on horror movie season here. You know, we're getting into, you know,
we're
it's almost September,
August.
You know, Yeah, you know, so there's going to be the movies coming out and all that. And I actually just had a brief conversation with somebody at work today because he was saying something about, oh, yeah, I went to the movies the other day and I saw the preview for the new Exorcist movie, which, you know, is Blumhouse, of course. And he was going, Danny McBride wrote it? And I was like, well, yeah, you know, he did the Halloweens and stuff like that, you know. But so, yeah, I got to ask you, you know, not just about that one, but about what of the slate of horror movies coming out here are you looking forward to, or are you rolling your eyes at all of them, or what's up?
So I have The Exorcist in my calendar because I gave up watching movie trailers a number of years ago. So at this point, I don't know when anything comes out anymore. My visual memory of seeing, like, coming, you know, August 28th, I don't have that anymore.
Right.
So I usually sit in the movie theater and I'll see the trailer. As soon as I can identify somebody in the film, I look it up on IMDb. I find what movie it is. I find the release date. I put it in my calendar. So The Exorcist has been in my calendar as The Exorcist BS for a very long time. I hate that it exists. I don't want it to exist, but of course I will be there to see it. I'm hearing good things about the trailer. That doesn't always get you somewhere, but I will say, and this is a rarity, so you may, you know, big time listening gold right here. I really was angry that Fox made a TV show out of it, but it's a really good show. It's a really good show. Especially the second season, which is not something you typically hear from people. I really enjoyed what they did with that. So I was like, okay, so maybe I can be slightly optimistic about this new thing. It's probably going to be terrible, but, you know, whatever it is. And then Talk to Me came out recently. That's an A24, and I really enjoyed that. So anybody who is considering that one, definitely worth your time. Not quite the movie that they advertise in the trailer. I do eventually watch them, usually when I'm in the car after seeing the film. Before I drive home, I usually watch the trailer while it's fresh in my mind. that was a cool one. And apparently they just released they just announced a sequel for that.
I saw something about that this morning. Yeah.
Oh, I'm not happy. That does not need a sequel. It is good just the way it is. Leave it alone. But speaking of sequels, Saw 10. Saw X is coming out. I don't know if it's properly 10 because there have actually only been 8 movies, so I don't know what this X is. I guess they're counting Spiral, which is terrible. But yeah, I'm actually excited about a new Saw movie, which is embarrassing to admit, but I am who I am. I can't help it. But yeah, no, there's a Dracula film coming out this week with has the
Last Voyage of the Demeter. Yeah,
thank you. It's basically and see, this is what I don't quite understand, is how the whole movie is going to be like a footnote in the novel. You know, like, oh, Dracula crossed the ocean and terrible things happened. And so this movie is about the terrible things that happen. It's like when they remade When a Stranger Calls, and the new version of the movie was literally the first, like, 15, 20 minutes of the old movie stretched out over an hour and a half, and it was awful. So I don't know how this is going to turn out. We'll have to see.
The Last Voyage of the Demeter is like, you know, you don't watch the trailers, but, you know, I don't mind the trailers. And I have been going to the movies a lot more this summer. I finally decided I'm going to get the pass and go when I want to go. And that trailer is like been showing all the time. It's like every movie I go to, you know, I sit in there and I'm going, well, Nicole Kidman hasn't shown up yet, but we probably got Last Voyage of the Demeter and then Nicole will come on the screen, you know. And sure enough, like every time that trailer plays, and I'm interested, you know, I'm not saying it's necessarily going to be the top of my list to go see it, but you know, if I'm got a free afternoon and I'm going, okay, what haven't I seen yet? I may check that one out.
Yeah, I mean, I'll see it eventually. I'm just trying to decide if I'm going to see it in the theater or not. Embarrassingly, I still haven't seen Oppenheimer. And I am a Nolan fangirl, so definitely fangirl fail right now. I was away when it released, because normally I would have gone that day, done.
Mm-hmm.
But I've just been weirdly busy since, and anytime I have time to go see it, the movie started an hour ago. Or it's like, oh, okay, I can go this time, but then, you know, it's going to go too long and run into an appointment I've got. So I'm trying to, like, find a three-hour space where it starts and I am able to be there when it starts and also see the whole thing. So it's getting tricky, but I will get there. If I have to take a day off from something, I will get there.
Well, yeah, I went last Friday. It was the third Friday of its release, so it's been out for a while. And I typically don't have to work the afternoons on Fridays, so that a lot of times will be my movie time. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go see Oppenheimer. And I went, you know, to the IMAX screen because, you know, everybody says that's the way to see it and all that. And I was amazed, you know, on the third Friday of release in, you know, the biggest theater in the complex. Okay, I won't say it was sold out, but it was 2/3 full. You know, it's pretty much just the front few rows that were empty. And yeah, people are still turning out for this thing. So that's cool. And
that is awesome.
And it was a great time at the movies. It's excellent. Of the things I've seen this year so far of the 2023 releases, it's sitting right there at number one for me right now. So yeah.
That's good to hear. Unfortunately, I won't be able to do the IMAX though, because it makes me queasy.
Oh,
I can't do it. I can't do the IMAX theater. It makes me sad.
That's the 3D for me. See, that's yeah.
Yeah, I really did try when they released Jurassic Park in IMAX, and we were approaching the Tyrannosaurus, you know, paddock scene. And I was starting to get queasy and I closed my eyes for a good chunk of those scenes before it. Cause I'm like, I'm not missing the Tyrannosaurus on this screen. I will not do it. It's the whole reason I went. But yeah, it was a struggle. So I can't do it.
Well, let's get on with our movie here today. Definitely
another
not
classic.
One that was, not formatted for IMAX or anything like that, but that's okay. This is called The First Power, released in 1990, written, directed by a guy named Robert Reznikoff. That's about all the information I have on this man. It just didn't do a whole lot else. The only thing that I saw in his very small filmography that jumped out at me is apparently he wrote the 1989 buddy cop comedy Collision Course, which stars Jay Leno and Pat Morita. Other than that, I don't know what this guy's been doing. So sorry, I don't have a whole lot of background information this time around.
He's really forgotten.
But this film, it centers on a police detective named Russell Logan, played by Lou Diamond Phillips. And he is obsessed with stopping a string of recent murders, the work of a serial killer who has been dubbed the Pentagram Killer. And this is basically because he often carves a pentagram in the flesh of his victims. So one night, Logan gets a mysterious call from a woman who seems to know a lot about the murders, and she claims to know where the killer will strike next. But she has a condition for giving this information. She makes Logan promise that if they catch him, they are not going to seek the death penalty. So she ends up giving the information, and the police set up their operation, complete with an undercover female cop as bait. And the killer, a guy named Patrick Channing, played by Jeff Kober, he shows up. He is a devoted worshiper of Satan, apparently. And, of course, he takes the bait. And after a bit of a chase and a fight with Logan, he ends up getting captured. So Logan ends up getting a bunch of media attention over this. But, of course, the state is going to be seeking the death penalty. I mean, ultimately, does the detective that catches the guy, does he really have that much control over what the kind of charges and all that?
Seriously.
No. But anyway, so they go after the death penalty. And actually, this serial killer, he seems to want that too, which is a little bit weird. So I guess everybody gets what they want because they execute the guy. But then the female cop who had been captured by the killer earlier turns up dead with a pentagram carved into her chest. Now then, Logan gets a visit from the woman who called him earlier, a psychic named Tess Seton, played by Tracy Griffith, and she tells him that the pentagram killer is back. He has now achieved the power of resurrection, so killing him doesn't matter. And not only that, but he also has the ability to possess others and make them do his dirty work. And so, of course, he now has his eye set on Logan and Tess, since they are the ones who caused his downfall the last time. Eventually, they end up recruiting a crucifix knife-wielding nun to help out in this whole thing to bring down this serial killer before he kills even more. Now, this film is a odd mix of a police procedural, a serial killer film, and a supernatural thriller. So I'm going to let Lisa get us started here. Give us a few of your thoughts on The First Power.
Well, I mean, you offered me a couple of options, and one of them being, hey, a serial killer is, you know, put to death and comes back as a kind of demon possessing people and killing people from beyond the grave. And it's like, yeah, that's the one. Definitely that one. The one that's got a lot of death and destruction and misery. And that's my bag. So I'm surprised I had not heard of this, because this is right around the sweet spot of like the suspense thrillers in the early 90s. And mm-hmm. I love a lot of those. I'm not sure how this got past me, because this seems like it would have been like right up my mother's alley too. This would have been something that would have shown up on like TBS some Saturday afternoon, and we absolutely would have watched it. So for all I know, I've seen it before and just blocked it out.
So you saying that this is up your mother's alley now, you know, gives me a better idea as to what Lisa ticks, I gotta say.
It's so true. And it's funny, because when I was a kid, I was scared of everything. And I mean, I was brought up on, you know, Unsolved Mysteries and Rescue 911 and Stephen King miniseries events. So, I mean, this was it in our house. Like, we were very excited. So, yeah, I had a movie upbringing. My father was into like some of the bigger movies and the classic black and whites, and my mother was into the thrillers and the suspense and the true crime. So, That's where I come from. But yeah, oh, you give me a possession movie and I am there. I don't care how bad it is. This one isn't awful. It has its problems. It definitely has its problems. But I kind of dug some of the setups. I liked a couple of the peripheral characters. You know, I had fun with this one. I think that, you know, this is a film and this is a premise that has been done better in other places. And, you know, I'll talk about that a little later. But, you know, it's kind of an interesting idea if they had stuck with one of their ideas, because you're right. It is the police procedural. It's also the possession film. It's also the serial killer film. And there were a couple of times where I think it just didn't quite know what to do with itself, because it was, you know, too many balls were in the air.
Yeah. I mean, in my notes, I put down the film is messy, but it certainly has its charms. I mean, ultimately, I guess the story is kind of silly, but I think that the film kind of lives for those sillier moments, and the moments that kind of make you almost roll your eyes a bit. But I admire the film's bravery for doing some of those things that you kind of know, you know, we're going to think are ridiculous. I mean, like, it's not afraid to throw out a dream sequence or some scene where it, or like, you know, where a character is having a vision of something, you know, and, you know, it does these things just so that they can do something crazy with it, you know, and, you know, so yeah, you're kind of sitting there wondering, all right, is this real or are we just going on another weird, we're having a moment type of a scene here? And in some ways, I think that type of stuff kind of hit me with what the vibe of this film was ultimately going to be. You know, when, I guess early on, the film kind of clued me into the weird tone it was going to have, because we have this whole police setup, this sting that they're doing to try and catch the guy after Lou Diamond Phillips has gotten this information. And he captures the female cop, and he's wearing this rubber mask, which, you know, all right, you know, are they going to go the masked killer thing, whatever. You know, they don't stick with it too much, but he's got this rubber mask. And then he's talking and all that, and he takes off the rubber mask, and so help me, the guy's actual face looks like the rubber mask.
It's so true. I just couldn't handle looking at this guy. I'm like, what happened to you as a child? Like, did you take boxing as a child? Like, were you a kid who, you know, got into all of the hockey fights? He just looks like a kid who was like a former athlete who just got beat up every chance he could. I'm like, oh, this poor guy.
Yeah. And I mean, they do delve into some pretty grim backstory with the guy eventually and all.
Another
that, you know, that
random thing. Yes.
Yeah. That suggests there was some abuse going on in his household and whatnot. But I mean, the film is really kind of just all over the place, like you say, with the things that it's throwing at you. And yeah, I can't really complain about that all that much, because, you know, every time it did something weird, I was like, all right, this is strange. This feels a little out of place. It's not necessarily being executed terribly well, but am I enjoying it? Yeah.
For some reason, like, it's still entertaining. I mean, you kind of roll your eyes and go, all right, stop with the stupid things. Get back to the silliness. There are these moments where you're like, all right, fine. I see what you're trying to do, but get on with it.
Well, and I guess one of the weird things about the movie, and I guess, you know, as a connoisseur of the horror movies, of the supernatural stuff, I'll be interested to hear what you think about this. But the film doesn't really have any rules to it. I mean, yeah. There's all these things that this killer is somehow able to do, you know, because he worships Satan or whatever. But it feels like the film just kind of, you know, whenever they need him to do something extraordinary, okay, that's a power that he has. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yep. And you have this religious element that comes in. You have this symbology element that comes in. You have this sort of like nickel and dime store idea of what Satanism kind of is. I mean, you're dealing with a decade that is just after the satanic panic of, like, you know, the 70s and 80s, when there were plenty of movies and plenty of stories out there about Satanism. And it kind of seems like, you know, the writer lived in a bubble and heard none of the rumors about what Satanism actually is, except for the pentagram.
Well, and it almost seems like it's also somewhat rooted in the heavy metal culture of the 80s and the satanic imagery. And again, just very much like, it's just kind of the surface thing of that. You know, we're just going to throw a few images around and you know, call it devil worship. You know, and that's what it is.
And I think that that's a big downfall here, because they're trying to get into something that, when done, I don't want to say well, done appropriately, done accurately, something like that, it really will hit with the right audience. You know, you take those religious films of the late 60s into the 70s, and sort of like that Catholic guilt and Christian guilt that people are coming out of. And those are the films that really work, because if you have people who are raised in these faiths, these films are going to work. I'll tell you, that's why they work so well for me. I was raised Catholic. I still consider myself Catholic, even though I'm kind of a holiday heathen at this point. But it's, you know, if you start in with the religious iconography, you need to know what you're talking about. And this is somebody who has no idea about any of it. Like, you start off with a scene with higher ups in this faith community, and a nun who is saying, this is what's happening, this is what's happening, and they're dismissing her. You know, she comes back at a later point in the film, and it's like, we kind of think she knows what she's talking about, but we don't actually know how to explain any of it, so we're just going to have her slam the door in people's face. Like, it just, if you're going to go the religious route, get a consultant on your script, get somebody who knows how to do this, because it's not that hard to find people who can work with this. And it will get you that particular audience that you're aiming for. But when you just kind of throw it together, you know, if I'm suddenly going to do a horror film about, let's say, the Jewish faith, right? Like, you have a movie about the Dybbuk box or something like that. I wasn't raised in that faith. So I'm not going to, you know, willy-nilly throw some possibilities out there of what I think the Jewish faith believes. I'm going to get somebody who knows what it's about and how to actually get to the heart of that fear. And that obviously was not done here.
Well, and they kind of abandoned the Catholicism angle of things for a good portion of the film, because, like, say, it starts with a scene where we have this nun and she's being confronted by the priest, the Monsignor. By the way, we have to mention one of the priest, or the Monsignor, is played by David Gale of Reanimator fame. I have to mention that.
Yes.
But, you know, there's this whole moment where they're talking with her and telling her, you can't do this stuff and blah, blah, blah. And then we abandon this nun character for a good chunk of the movie.
Right.
You know, it isn't until a little bit later on where you have Lou Diamond Phillips, you know, kind of goes into a church and he's struggling with some things. He goes to confession and all that, where we start to bring the element back in. I was really surprised that the nun that they introduce us to at the beginning is not the woman who calls Lou Diamond Phillips at the beginning of the film. You know, when he's sitting there in his apartment talking on the phone, and we cut away and we see just the lips of the woman who is speaking to him on the other end of the phone. We don't see her full face. So my first thought was, oh, that's the nun. She's left. She's
that
now
red lipstick.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I thought she had, you know, moved away from the church or something like that. And so now she was doing the lipstick thing, and she was calling up cops and telling them that there were serial killers out there, you know. So I thought that was the direction it was going to go. So, you know, when that didn't happen, and then it took another hour or so for the nun to come back, I was kind of surprised by that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That would have been an interesting element to it too. Like, just to have that be the twist and talk about, you know, the nun who left the faith that didn't believe in her and turns out she actually has this psychic power too. Like, that would have been cool.
Yeah.
But no, we can't do that. That, no. The nun doesn't look like Tawny Katane. And at this time of year, at this decade, right, we're only a few years after Witchboard, right? You know, we got to have a Tawny Katane lookalike in our film.
Yes, and we do get that for sure.
Well, at least our hair looks like Tawny.
Well, before we get to talking a bit more about the actors and actresses, their performances, etc., let's talk a bit more about our killer here and kind of the, you know, this wide array of powers that he seems to be able to do. You know, I mean, the main one is being able to possess people and such, but give me your thoughts on that. And then I guess maybe, you know, there's some other things that he pulls out here and there. I guess what are your favorite superpowers for this guy?
Frankly, I was impressed at his acrobatic prowess. I mean, he could just do a backflip and kick you on his way around. He can, you know, spin around this pole, around that pole. Like, this person is very nimble.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a, I don't know, I'd probably say fairly middle-aged man, I doubt the knees allow such a thing. I am skeptical.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like every big moment he's like jumping through a window, like, say, doing backflips to kick people. You know, I mean, you could almost call it martial arts that he's doing in some of these scenes. And you know, of course, along with that is the ability to jump off of a roof, fall 20 stories and land on your feet like a cat before running off.
Very graceful. Yes. He was impressive. And just, you know, say goodbye and, you know, run away. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, they pulled off that stunt pretty well, too, I would say, because, I mean, the camera follows the guy all the way down. You actually see him land. I mean, yeah, credit to the stuntman that pulled that one off. It looks good.
I will say it does look pretty good. I mean, you can see the cable, you know, if you go back and watch it again. But, I mean, it did catch me off guard. Like, when he landed, I was like, oh, because I thought it was like a dummy, you know, like a fake body that was going to, because I thought at that point that person whom he had possessed was going to be killed, right? Because this was the whole gimmick that he possesses somebody's body, but he allows for Logan to be able to see him as himself, right? As Channing. So I thought that body, I thought it was going to be fake, and he was going to, you know, I thought they were going to cut away before he actually hit the ground, and he actually, like, gracefully landed. I was like, oh, wait, hang on. Like, it really threw me. It's not something you expect to happen in that moment at all.
Well, and he does pull a trick like what you just described later in the film, because there's that chase slash fight that goes on at, I don't even know what it was. It looks like an oil refinery or something like that, where they're climbing up the stairways and you know, they're on the catwalks and things like that.
Right.
And he, Lou Diamond Phillips, sends the guy sailing, you know, the killer sailing over the edge, and he falls, and we think he's dead. And then it turns out it's this other cop that that had been kind of on his case and all that. And this was another case where he had possessed that person. Apparently it's not just possession, but it's shape-shifting too, because, you know, at some moments he looks like the person he's possessed, and in other moments it looks like the actual killer. So yeah, it's just another example of how the powers are a little fuzzy here. They get away with whatever they want.
Yeah, they just sort of keep going with it instead of finding any real continuity. So, I mean, they explain it away, but then it's not consistent with what we're shown. So you say, okay, you know, so because we're looking at Channing, you know, like, we actually see the killer. We see Jeff Cober play Jeff Cober's face, right? And he's doing the things. And then we find out that, oh, you know, we find out from Tess, he actually will make you see what he wants you to see. So he wants you to know it's him, but everybody else sees some, you know, some drug addict off the street, or, you know, a homeless individual who he's taking advantage of, and then sort of discards that body. But then there's scenes where that isn't revealed to us, right? So it sometimes is and sometimes isn't. And it throws the continuity off, because then you expect a scene like what you just mentioned, where it turns out that it was another cop who ends up impaled on one of these pipes, you know, almost like the Omen style. And, right. You end up with a conversation between Logan and, I don't know, his lieutenant or whatever, saying, you expect me to think that Grimes tried to kill you? And it's like, that's what more of this could have, should have been. But they were inconsistent with it. So it's like, I wonder if the movie was longer and they just cut that stuff out because it was too much exposition or what? Because you can't set it up and then not be consistent with it.
I got the impression that there were quite a few moments that ended up on the cutting room floor that might have kind of expanded the idea that the other cops are getting suspicious of Lou Diamond Phillips, you know, thinking maybe he's the killer because, you know, it's the cops who are all ending up dead and in dramatic fashion.
And the fact that they kept him on as long as they did is mind blowing. There is no way. I mean, but there were at least, what, three cops before they were like, oh, I don't know. Yeah, get that girl and get her out of here. After three cops have been killed, get her. Come on.
Right. And like I say, they're just in this bizarre circumstances. I mean, like the one that I just had to go back and look again on was where the one cop is hanging from the underside of a bridge.
Right.
Crucified, basically, you know, hanging there 100 feet in the air, you know. And they're going, how did he get up there and all that stuff? And again, you know, talking about the stunts, it sure looks to me if that was a dummy, they did a great job, because that looked to me like that's the actual actor hanging that high up in the air.
I mean, that was a Thomas Harris moment. That was some good Silence of the Lambs death right there. That was absolutely their best kill.
And see, you know, there's all those killings going on, and you get little hints here and there that the police chief is a little suspicious, that he's, you know, wondering what's really up with Lou Diamond Phillips, but it's not expanded on. There's a moment, too, where I thought, oh, there's something big that must have ended up on the cutting room floor, where there's the one scene, and it's after the whole thing with the with the horse and buggy, which we got to talk about the horse and buggy.
Oh, but,
but Lou Diamond Phillips grabs the girl, the psychic, Tess, and they go off in a car to chase in the guy. And then they end up at this building, and Lou Diamond Phillips goes in to chase the guy through the building. And he leaves the girl in fact, he straps her in with a seatbelt. And it sure looks to me like she's in handcuffs at this point. And we never see him put the handcuffs on her.
That's
so true. I'm like, what ended up on the cutting room floor here, you know?
I just thought that was one of my favorite moments. I actually stopped the movie and took a note. I'm like, oh, yes, the seatbelt is absolutely going to keep her right there. I'm like, are you, like, he literally reaches over and belts her in and goes, you stay here. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that'll hold her.
Yeah.
What? Whose idea was that?
Well, we got to talk about the horse and buggy. Like I said, this is one of the moments where I was like, well, regardless of how this movie goes, regardless of how silly it gets, I got to admire the movie for having guts in this sequence, because you don't often see a movie where one of the first major kills is you have a cop get trampled by a horse pulling like an Amish style buggy.
Yes.
The cop, by the way, Lou Diamond Phillips' partner, we didn't mention, is McKelty Williamson.
Before
Forrest Gump. This is a few years before Forrest Gump. But he gets trampled by the horse. And then, you know, as he's dying, and you know, he's like, it was him, I saw him. And then they get in the car and they chase the horse and buggy through the streets of Los Angeles.
And nobody, again, like, what happened to the guy that he possessed who was driving the buggy?
None of
that ever comes up.
And you see the killer there driving the buggy, you know, complete with a giant sombrero on his head. And I was like, well, this film's got guts. Yeah, certainly. But, I mean, if we're talking wild moments in this, I got to talk about, this is my favorite scene. And, you know, again, it's another chase. A lot of this is just, we see the killer, we chase the killer type of thing.
Oh, I have a feeling I know where you're going.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I mean, this is a scene where they are chasing the guy. And first of all, this is a scene where they fool us a couple times leading up to this, because Lou Diamond Phillips is going, you know, to find the guy. He goes into this Skid Row hotel, goes up, he's searching around the hallway. The guy pops out of a broom closet and buries an axe in Lou Diamond Phillips' head. Only he doesn't, because we cut away and it's a vision that our psychic character has had. Now she scurries off to go help him. And then we cut with the real scene. Now Lou Diamond Phillips going into the Skid Row Hotel, blah, blah, blah. She catches up to him. We stop him from getting killed with an axe. But then the killer reaches up to the ceiling, pulls down the ceiling fan, points the blades at our two heroes, and the thing starts spinning and he's chasing him down. There's no power source.
None.
It's not connected to the wall. There's no electrical cord. And again, I'm like, apparently the power of Satan allows you to power a ceiling fan in your bare hands and chase after people. This is, I mean, you know, we have a killer in this movie that does not have like his own signature weapon. We're not talking Jason's machete or Freddy's razor claws or whatever. But this guy goes after folks with a ceiling fan that has no power source. I got to give it up for that. Yeah. You
it's
know?
Like his chainsaw powered ceiling fan. Like, it just, did someone grab a leaf blower and somehow finagle this thing to work? Because it's absolutely fantastic. It is one of the best moments in the whole film.
And it's spinning at a speed where you're going like, shouldn't he be like taking off? I mean, that's like airplane propeller speed, you know? It's
absolutely true.
Crazy. All right. Well, let's talk about our cast here. I mean, Lou Diamond Phillips is our lead. It's interesting just to look at the way his career went, because, you know, he hit big in the 80s with La Bamba.
Yeah.
You know, he's great in that movie. He's in the Young Guns films, which I think he's solid in that. But, I mean, his career has not lived up to those first few outings.
He was red hot for a while.
Yeah. And, I mean, he keeps working, but a lot of it is in, like, these kind of police, you know, B-movie police thriller type of things. But I guess, what do you think of him in this one?
I mean, he's not awful. But he's not good either. There are times when, I buy him as a cop. And then there are times when I really just don't. Not even a little bit. Like the scene when he's trying to track down Carmen, the cop who the killer has gotten. I've already forgotten the killer. Channing. What Channing has kind of gotten. And so he and Michael T. Williamson are sort of looking for him. And he's sort of like, as he's going up the steps, you can hear that he's, you know, he's making too much noise. And then he's sort of like jumping down and he's sort of got the gun and he's looking around this corner and looking around that corner. I'm like, this is so very clearly like, this is an actor pretending to be a detective. And here's how I'll sneak around this corner. It feels very much like this is an actor playing a role. And the realism of it is just not there at all. You know, there are moments where I was looking at, you know, for example, when they find Carmen's body and I'm looking at her lying in the body bag and I'm like, that neck wound doesn't look real either. Like, too much of it becomes this weird element of, do I believe this? Do I not believe it? And I'm kind of impressed by how much they kept bringing me back, even though it was awful through most of it. Like, they lost me so many times, and yet I just kept coming back. Like, he's got this Tom Cruise risky business bravado when he's at the courthouse, and he's, like, the media star. And then he's, what was it, the champagne that he spills on himself because he's, I don't know, is he an idiot or is he drunk? Like, you can't tell because there's not enough information about the character. There was one scene where he has a nightmare because everybody has these visions and dreams. And I swear to you, there's a rose on his pillow. Did you see this thing?
Yes.
And
it's, yes. Yes.
Never acknowledged. He never sees it. I'm like, where did this thing come from? And I kept waiting for it to happen and nothing. It's just like, what? He has this thing. Is he a player? What's going on? Is there a romance? Is there not? Like, they can't figure it out. And I think he suffered as a result of a script that didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying there. I mean, you know, when I think back to those earlier performances, Lou Diamond Phillips, I mean, I like him. I like what he brings to a lot of those movies. And I think here, though, I don't know, he seems like he's struggling a bit with the tone of the film. Mm-hmm. And I suppose maybe you could say that everyone involved is struggling a bit with the tone of the film because the tone is all over the place. But kind of like you said, I mean, I think he goes back and forth between like, I'm this cocky, confident cop. And then in other moments, he really seems confused. He seems like he's struggling. It seems like half the time his answer to every situation is like to fire his gun in the air, you know, things like that, or just
multiple times.
Look tough about something. And it just doesn't work. He actually more often comes off more like a whiny teenager. And I don't know. I had a difficult time just, you know, him selling me, I guess, on him in this role. And I think like what you said, though, the saving grace of the movie is that it just gets so wacky that, you know, the weakness of the performances, you're kind of like, well, I'm still in, you know,
yes,
what I mean?
Somehow I'm still here.
How about Tracy Griffith? When I saw her on screen, I was like, she looks so familiar to me. I must have seen her in a dozen things. And I look at her filmography, I'm like, she hasn't been in that much. I mean, she's in Sleepaway Camp 3, but I can't imagine that's what I remember her from, you know. And I don't know. She just looks so familiar. But I don't know. I mean, I think from my point of view, I think she kind of struggles in a lot of the same ways that Lou Diamond Phillips does.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's because she's related to Melanie Griffith and you're like looking at her and seeing Melanie. I don't know. I see her as, you know, a Tawny Katane fill-in because she's trying to be sexy, but she's not sexy. And, you know, she talks about like failed relationships, and she's got that moment where she's kind of, you know, mysterious. Like, for example, those opening scenes you're talking about where we have just her lips, and it's very sensual. Mm-hmm. It's very much this very bright red lipstick. It's shadowy. It's just her mouth and the phone, and she's telling him these things, and she's sort of whispering into his ear. And then she shows up, and she's somebody who can't get out of her own way. And I mean, I guess that's endearing. I don't dislike the character, but I feel like, again, they didn't know what to do with her. Like, how on earth does she have the house that she lives in?
Right. Yeah.
She's got this beautiful house with an incredible view that they even joke about. They're like, oh, it's too bad the girl doesn't have a view when it's got this gorgeous view. Beautiful pool, like this weird entrance thing. Like, where does this come from? Because she says later on that all she does is field questions about people's love lives and their, like, job future.
Yeah.
So, again, like, this element of who are your characters? Like, how many different rewrites did this go through? Is the cop arrogant and brash and brave and, you know, reckless? You know, is this Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon, or is this, you know, is this Luther? You know, this is Idris Elba is the conflicted cop who doesn't quite know what to do, but he's still got the good morals and he's going to do everything he can to be a good cop because maybe he's not a great man. And you get this blend for Lou Diamond Phillips's character, and then you get this, is she sexy, is she the girl next door mix and mess with Tess. And it's like really the only one who's any good is Channing because he's just evil. Done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And that works, you know? Like, and he seems to be the only one having any fun in this film.
Yeah, I would say, you know, maybe a few other of the side characters. I mean, like, it's sad to see McKelty Williamson go, you know?
Oh, because he was gone too soon.
You know, he's one of those guys that doesn't matter what he's in, you know, it's kind of like, oh, it's Bubba. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Even if it was before he was Bubba, he's still Bubba, you know, so.
Yeah. I mean, you know who my favorite character was? The bag lady. That had a blast. Oh, my gosh. She was a riot. She was, and again, I don't mean to keep doing this, but I mean, she was like a modern day Carol Kane, you know?
Yes.
Like,
that's what I thought of. Absolutely.
Of like Ghost of Christmas Past and Scrooged, you know, but you could tell she was having a ball. And the way she delivered her lines, they were silly lines, but she didn't care. She was like full on cheese. I thought she was wonderful.
Well, and the way she's like floating outside of the window and doing these spins and things like that, it was so wonderfully playful and that. And then it just keeps going. That's one of the things that I loved about it was like she does this whole thing and then she bursts through the window and attacks and all that. And then when we think that we've gotten rid of her, nope, she's in the back seat of the car. She's going to get them anyway.
She must have impressed the director. Because everybody else who played some random that he, like, possessed was dispatched with pretty quickly. She kept coming back.
Also one that I liked as kind of a side player, and, you know, this is not someone that gets possessed, but I was like, oh, well, this is the creepiest character in the whole thing, is the grandmother of the killer.
My God, right?
because Lou Diamond Phillips and Tess. Yeah.
The actress's name. I don't remember. Griffith.
Tracy Griffith.
There it is.
They go to the killer's house and his grandmother is there and they're trying to find out more about him that. And for some reason, she lets them in and lets them poke around and all that. And as things go on and she's realizing they know more and more, she just gets creepier and creepier.
That's so weird.
Until, you know, when they leave, she's like shouting at them, you know, you're going to burn in hell and all this
stuff. And again, right, like this idea of the religious element. Right? Like, oh, is she just a sweet little church-going lady? At first, I didn't know if she was his mother. And then, like, it got into, you know, oh, that's my daughter. That's his mother. I went, oh, this is the grandmother. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like, again, none of this was really made clear.
I also loved that they go to his room, the killer's room.
Oh, my God.
And it's like it was when he was a kid. It's been kept as he was a kid. And he's got, like, the creepiest toys, sheets, wallpaper, you know, of the 60s and 70s, all in one room there. It's like the yard sale from hell. It's just, you know, creepy clowns and all that stuff.
Still living there? Like, that's what he was sleeping in, that bed?
That's what I was trying to figure out. I was like, you know, did they just keep the room the way it was when he was a kid, or is he still living there? Maybe that was on the cutting room floor, too.
I couldn't track it because at first I was like, oh, okay, you know, go down and then this dark basement is his room and they'll find like a trophy box. But they go down there and it's this weird kid's room that appeared to have a trophy box. But again, you know, they didn't explain any of that. It's not what it, you know, I say trophy box because I've seen how many serial killer movies and that's what it always is. But again, not acknowledged at all.
Well, before we take it to the break here, I guess any closing thoughts? I mean, it's, you know, we've kind of said it's a movie that's got a lot of problems, but it's still kind of fun. I guess, you know, as the big fan, the big expert on the horror genre here, where are you going to put this one?
No, this isn't something I would recommend to anybody. I mean, there's so many random things. Like, you've got a nun who has a religious artifact that's a crucifix with Jesus on the cross that actually has a dagger in it. I was like,
yeah,
this, I mean, to go back to Scrooge, frankly, that's something that he would have made for his TV channel, you know, like the nun with the violent nun or something, you know, like, it's ridiculous. And then you have this weird forced romantic moment.
Oh yeah. That came out of nowhere.
It's completely useless. You hear this bangings that's interrupting them because of course Channing's not going to let them have a moment, and thank God for Channing. I really was pretty happy that they didn't have their moment, and it was so forced and awkward. But you know, he hears these weird bangs and he's like, oh, that must be my refrigerator. But he pulls his gun to go investigate the refrigerator. I'm like, who is writing this? And like, did nobody watch this or read this and go, this makes no sense, what is happening here? And one more thing in my notes, because I was so excited when I saw this part in the movie. That moment when I was watching the film and Channing had this confrontation with Tess, like right in the third act, and he says the line, and I went, that is in the trailer. I know I will give my next paycheck. That's in the trailer. She says to him, you can't go on killing forever, Patrick. And he goes, you want to bet? And I went, that is so in the trailer. Lo and behold, guess what's at the end of the trailer? I'm like, of course. Yes. Because it's so bad. Like, somebody you know, when you have people who like think they write well and they're like, this is the money line. And it's like, it really isn't though. And that's what this is an example of. Like, oh, that was bad. Like, people were with that movie for the entirety of that trailer. And then they got to that line and they went, you know what? Maybe I'll wait until this is on home VHS before I watch it.
Well, there's a couple of weird lines throughout this thing. The one that got me was where our two leads are walking and talking with each other, and she keeps finishing his sentences, and he's like, "Will you stop that?" And she says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. Like, I forgot I'm a psychic.
I forgot I was psychic, but she wasn't saying anything that was weird. Did you notice that too? Like, the two sentences she finished, any of us would have finished. They were all very, very normal sentences. And I'm like, well, at least make it fancy. At least make us earn that one. But no.
Yeah. Yeah. This film is wild. It's I think we're very much on the same page. I mean, I can't sit here and say this is a great achievement. This is a fantastic example of a police thriller mixed with a serial killer horror movie. I mean, no. But I do admire the guts the movie has.
Yes.
And for every moment that's just had me going, what am I watching? I mean, still, I enjoyed the experience. I mean,
right?
it's a movie that it's like, well, I'm glad that I got to just see some of the weird directions that this world of cinema can go, because this is one that I think, like I say, I can't say that it's good, but is it fun to watch? Absolutely.
It really is. I mean, it's that sugar candy kind of movie. You know, like, this is Lifetime movies before there were Lifetime movies. Like, this is Mother May I Sleep With Danger level. You know, like, just this silly thing that you find on TV late at night and you're too lazy to change the channel and you're like, fine, I'll just watch it. And it's actually not so terrible because you're like, this is weird. What am I even watching? And you can't look away.
Right.
So, I mean,
right.
You know what? I gotta give them that. They got something that hooked the two of us, even though it was completely absurd.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break here. We'll hear from another Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
MovieMavericks.com, broadcasting current box office breakdowns, movie news, and reviews. Now for your hosts, Jason and Trevor.
Hey now, even though we're over 200 episodes deep into the Movie Mavericks podcast, it's still not too late to start listening.
Where every show we give you 10 truths, 20 lies, and a bunch of Hollywood secrets.
It's like existentialism slipping into nihilism.
MovieMavericks.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can now help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can support the show and earn access to some great bonus features in the process. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
We've brought back those good old time flavors, and today they're better than ever. All these delicious treats are waiting for you at the refreshment stand. Delicious fresh popcorn, ice-cold cola, tasting candy you know and love. They're all ready for you now, so you won't have to miss any of the feature. Come and get them.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie that we've enjoyed, something we want everybody else to check out. It might be a forgotten film, maybe an old classic, maybe something that's new in the theaters or on streaming. It could be anything. So, Lisa, what is your recommendation?
So, my recommendation, same decade, the other end of the decade, though, and much darker in tone. Like, this is a movie that actually gets dark, and you get pretty well creeped out by it. So, this is 1998's Fallen, which I'm sure many of your listeners know, because if they're listening to a film about a serial killer, chances are they know this one. This is Denzel Washington as a homicide detective, and he sees the serial killer killed. And strangely, after he's dead, a lot of killings begin again, and they're very similar to what they were. But he's dead. How could this be? Shock, surprise. Elias Koteas plays the serial killer, and Elias Koteas is just one of those brilliant character actors that it doesn't matter what he does, he is off his rocker 120%, and I love him for it. I mean, my first introduction to Elias Koteas was as Casey Jones in the old Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movies.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, and he was great then. So, I mean, I guess there are probably higher quality films to know him from, but that was my first. And I don't know. So there are some brilliant actors that their first movies for me are really questionable. I go to High Spirits, which was my introduction to Liam Neeson and Peter O'Toole. To know Peter O'Toole first from High Spirits is shameful. But anyway, Elias Koteas plays the serial killer, and Denzel Washington is working with the incredible chef's kiss, makes every movie he's in better, John Goodman.
Yes, and this is at the time when Goodman was in every other movie that came out, you know, and that's fine with me.
Yes. I mean, the Coen brothers love him now. Like, you know, he just shows up and instantly the movie is better. For 5 minutes, the movie is, it doesn't matter because I just adore him. I think he's outstanding. You've got Donald Sutherland. You've got James Gandolfini. There's a ton of people in this film. More of those that guy kinds of characters, too. It's almost a little who's who of some of the early, you know, Sopranos kinds of stuff, too. But it's a very dark film because Denzel Washington is being sort of stalked and haunted by this guy, Edgar Reese. And he's jumping from person to person, and he's got this great use of the Rolling Stones song, Time is on My Side.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very haunting. And so it's just one of those films that I think people come across and they go, oh, this was so good. But it's not a film people remember right away, right? Like you talk about, oh, give me your top five recommendations for a really great serial killer movie. And, you know, people are going to give you The Silence of the Lambs, or they're going to give you Copycat, or they're going to give you, you know, Zodiac. They're not going to come up with Fallen. Right. And that's probably going to be maybe in the top 20 if you're lucky. Like, for whatever reason, people know this movie. They know how good it is, but yet it's not at the tip of your tongue. So watching The First Power very much made me think of Fallen, which did it so much better 8 years later. And it's just, it's one of those films that now I have to go back and revisit because it's just such a wonderful film. It gives you chills watching it. It just absolutely makes your skin crawl. And that's what you need in a real good, down and dirty serial killer kind of movie, right? Like, think of Seven, right? The grittiness of Seven. Everybody remembers Seven, but not enough people remember Fallen. So I had to recommend it here.
I am glad you brought this one up because I had forgotten this one. It used to be, I remember back in the day, this was on cable all the time. And, you know, I remember enjoying it quite a bit, but it's been forever since I saw it. And as you kept mentioning different aspects of it, I was going, oh yeah, I remember that. Okay. You know, and it's just wild too, just to think about Denzel Washington in a supernatural serial killer movie, you know, I mean, come on. And you mentioning Elias Koteas too. I mean, just, I had to go, once you said he was in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movies, I was like, oh yeah, what else was he in? let me bring it all back to my mind here. And I'm looking at his filmography, I'm going, this is a guy, why does he not pop into my mind when I'm thinking, who are great character actors out there?
Right.
Look at all the stuff this guy has been in. I mean, you know, it's, oh boy.
And he's always nuts. And he's always so entertaining. Like, it doesn't matter if he's playing some creep or if he's playing just the offbeat weird guy. Like, he's fun in every role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great pick. Well, the movie that I am going to recommend, I went with another, I guess, serial killer-ish type movie. Though it's kind of more of a traditional, like, 80s slasher type thing. And I think the reason I came to this one was because of that weird latex mask that we talked about from The First Power. That's
yes.
Only in a scene or two, but for some reason that brought to mind a mask that is used in another slasher movie. And it's only used in like one scene of the movie. This movie is not one where it's like a masked killer the whole time, but in one scene he wears a mask, and I'm pretty sure the mask is actually Stan Laurel, if I remember correctly. But anyway, I'm talking about 1980s New Year's Evil.
Yeah.
Which it focuses on a MTV VJ type of character who's doing a big New Year's Eve call-in broadcast. And, of course, some guy calls in and says he's going to commit murder at midnight. And basically the idea is that somebody is going to get killed when each time zone hits midnight. So there's going to be like four killings throughout the night. It's a pretty effective little slasher, right? It's not as gory or grisly as some of the 80s slashers, but it's got some good moments. One of the things that I think is really cool about it is, like I said, even though there is a scene with a mask, this is not a mask-wearing psycho type of thing. He's actually a normal, handsome guy. You know, he's just some guy that's a part of the crowd, which in some ways kind of makes him scarier because he's just, you know, you don't peg him as the villain. He kind of blends in with everybody else.
I mean, that goes back to, you know, Ted Bundy kind of stuff, you know, like just the normal everyday dude.
Right.
And this is what he's doing at night, like horrifying.
It's weird watching this because the movie is somewhat prophetic, just in terms of kind of predicting MTV several years before it happens.
Yeah.
And I love the lead in this, the lead central character, this VJ, is played by Roz Kelly. And if you're a kid of the 70s like me, you remember Roz Kelly because she played Pinky Tuscadero on Happy Days. She was the Fonz's sometimes girlfriend, you know. And in this movie, she's really great. I mean, she plays this lady who is successful. She's confident. She's sexy. And she's not the damsel in distress, you know, but there's this guy that's terrorizing her big New Year's Eve show. And so she's seeing her whole world kind of collapsing around her. And I think she does a really great job with the material. So, I mean, it's not one of the iconic 80s slashers, but I think New Year's Evil is really solid. So I guess maybe when you're planning your New Year's Eve celebration, at the end of the year this year, maybe flip on New Year's Evil. I think you'll have fun with it.
Absolutely. I mean, we all need the holiday horror movies.
Well, Lisa, I want to thank you for being on the show. Please remind everybody of where they can find you and the various projects you've got going on.
Yeah, so you can catch me on the Rabbit Hole Podcasts Network. I am on Between the Scares, which is me and Jason Soto going through Jason Blum's oeuvre, if you will, oeuvre. I don't know. I can spell it, but I can't say it. it's what I get for trying to be fancy. And our book club podcast called Pictures and Conversations, which releases episodes on the 20th of every month. And you can catch me on whatever the heck, you know, the artist formerly known as Twitter, on X or Twitter, whatever the heck it's called, at Foolish Minion. And yeah, that's where my silly podcasting posts show up. And hey, you know, sometimes you catch me on other people's podcasts because I just kind of wander around and knock on doors and hopefully people will record with me.
Well, you're always welcome here.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the Forgotten Filmcast. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. You can find other reviews of Forgotten Films over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I'd love to hear your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, go watch a few old movies. We'll see you again real soon.
Look, Miss Seaton.
Tess.
Tess, right. I wanted...
You don't have to thank me.
But
Would you quit finishing my sentences for me, please?
Sorry. I forget sometimes.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.